do that, they can't make a stretch and they can't afford. And so the short but long-term effect, you know, from a healthcare perspective is the people that we take care of at our hospital are increasingly sick and ill. They come in with, you know, long-term ramifications of illnesses that they never would have come in with before. So an effect on the healthcare system is people are coming in sicker. They can't afford their medicines. If they can't afford their medicine, they make a stretch. If they make a stretch, they become more sick because they haven't managed their health, you know, the way that they should. And that, in the aggregate for, you know, society at large, is a huge cost and a huge burden, but an unfortunate side effect of where we are right now.
Dr. Hillier, I'll address this question to you and then invite other responses. The state report on Illinois poverty issued by the Heartland Alliance this year reported that 1 in 8 adults avoided the doctor within the past year because of cost. What does this mean for the child and more broadly the health care system?
Job of getting most of our kids on all kids who are uninsured, so access looks, issues with access probably look a little bit different just in terms of there's probably transportation issues, parents aren't work issues and things like that, but in Champaign, one of the things that you mentioned were the mental health issues that are associated with hunger, and there is a real gap here locally in service, in mental health services, so that's sort of one effect that comes to mind right away, but you know, also there's going to be every illness or disease is exacerbated by malnutrition or poor nutrition. So that's going to have an effect as well. But really the big mental health gap here is the first thing that comes to mind when I think about how our children are affected by that.
Other responses?
You know, I would add in that it really becomes, you know, a vicious cycle because, you know, you put off doing this because you're doing that. And then because you put off this happens, because this happens, then you have to go to the hospital with, you know, your disease state in a much more advanced state. So then you're in the hospital for a longer period of time, and then you have a larger bill, and then you, and so it becomes a self-perpetuating nightmare, you know, for some people. So, and that's just me being in the middle, you know, of all this, you know, when I take care of patients, you know, but it's a reality, you know, for many people that I think some of us aren't aware of, but it's true.
A question for anyone on the panel. What is the relationship between community, physical environment, and food security?
Well, I would say that, you know, communities really have to start kind of fundamentally relooking at how they're designed, because the reality is if you can't get the food, long distances, you know, for food if they can even afford it. And so I think in the long term, we're going to have to start redesigning some of our social structures to make sure that more people have access to them.
And I would agree with that, because when you look at where most of the people have to live who are food insecure and aren't possibly homeless or at the very low end of income levels, you don't see a lot of inexpensive access to food, either food banks or grocery stores that they can afford, or even grocery stores. It is a planning process, and I would like to also make my plea for more agriculture in the area to be more of our space turned over to growing food for humans, exactly, yes, for human beings. So those are just my thoughts on the whole thing. And I also would like to follow up with what Dr. Knight said. A lot of the kids that we work with in the homeless population and our food insufficiency population, a lot of them are the same kids, their health care we find comes when they are so sick their parents get scared and they go to emergency rooms. We try to work with them about wellness, try and get in, but it's real hard. A lot of them are working two jobs and, you know, they can't get in, but it's that emergency treatment. And if, like you said, if they would just start when the problem first started, they wouldn't be as sick and stay as sick as long and miss as much school and the whole cycle start over.
And just a follow-up to that, because you know, I've been at, you know, Cronell for 20 years, and when I came here, I think we were seeing something like 30,000 patients a year, and I think that we're on clip to see over 60,000 patients. And so,
emergency.
Right. And the issue when you, and sometimes I just have conversations with people and say, well, it's 3 a.m., why now? Well, it's because they're working two jobs, and the one person who could give them a ride could come at 3 a.m. So, you know, that's when they come. So I don't usually ask that question very often because I think I know now, but it's a reality.
Are there cost benefits for communities to try to reach out and assist food insecure children while they are very young?
Whenever you take a young child and you nurture that child, you're building a strong person. And whether it's a mental nurturance, if it's physical, one thing we haven't talked about and why children have so many problems, whether it's in school or just in life when they're going through this, is because what does a young child want more than anything in the whole
sure you're going to eat. You're not sure where you're going to sleep. You're not sure when mommy's at work or home. Or you're in a state of mind where you're very, very unsafe. And that is just critical to a young child. We get them the food they need. Their parents get jobs. They have a little more security. It's going to pay off in the long run. They're going to do better in school. They're going to grow up to be stronger people with a lot less baggage than what they're dealing with now. So my response to that is absolutely we put food security to our young children. I mean, our community should hold our children up above everything, in my opinion.
I would just echo that. And, you know, I don't think, I'm not aware of anyone doing a cost-benefit analysis to the community. But if you look at when you invest in early childhood programs and early childhood care, it comes back to the community tenfold in terms of economic benefits. So that when you're investing in particularly in children when they're young, you're investing in the future of the community. These are your future citizens. They're your future workers. But if your future workers are not getting good nutrition and good food when they're young, then they're not well equipped to be students, to be workers, to be leaders of the community. So if you could extrapolate the work that's been done in investment in early childhood education, I think probably the same thing would hold true in terms of economic benefits to the community.
I would add in too, you know, if you think about, you know, the world that we're in today, it's like at our hospital, if you can't use a computer, you almost can't get a job there. Now, there's a few positions that you still can, but many, it's like if I don't know how to use a computer, I can't work there as a doctor because that's how we do our work. But the challenge I think that we find too is that if these children are suffering educationally, how are they going to get the skill set to live in this, you know, technologically complex society in which we live? They'll be left behind, and that's just the reality of life.
It seems to me that there might be some negative impacts on the community when the issue of food insecurity is not addressed for children. I think they're obvious, including truancy, teen pregnancy, health problems, which we've talked about, and crime, yes? They're all nodding yes.
Well, I mean, I can't comment on any specific statistics. I mean, all I know is that people don't like to be very hungry for very long, and if they have to do something to eat, they might. But I don't have any true statistics on that to back up that statement.
Our fourth focus area is solutions, and these questions are addressed for anyone on the panel. What is the role of the individual in addressing childhood hunger?
Well, I think that's kind of what I was talking about at the beginning. We have this idea about personal responsibility, and food comes in and food comes out, but not everybody has choices. Not everybody has this wide variety of fruits and vegetables to choose from at their local Casey's. So there is some responsibility on individuals to make choices when they're given to them, but not everybody has those choices. I think that's where you have to look to the community and to governments and to businesses to make those choices available for people.
I was thinking about folks who are not in a food insecure mode that are listening to this on the radio, listening in the audience. Are there things that they could be thinking about and being part of the solution as an individual?
Well, I would add that there are many programs. I know our own Eastern Illinois Food Bank does food for families, donations online, all kinds of different marketing ideas to get the dollars in the door to pay for the food that go to these families already. So I would say, help us out. Donate. Anybody can give $5. I think, you know, you've heard Jim say about $10 buys, what, $100 worth of groceries, Jim, something like that. So, you know, your $10 translates into $100 for food for someone in this community that we've talked about tonight. So certainly economically, I think a lot of people can help that may not have thought about that before. Another thing would be to volunteer. We do food mobiles. We have volunteer jobs. Come on out. Go on the website. See when the next food mobile might be. Call up. Get on the rolls as a volunteer and see the faces of the people you're helping. It is very, very satisfying to help. You feel like, boy, I can affect this in some way, when sometimes it does feel so very hopeless. But to go out and actually lend your brawn to the problem is helpful. So that would be two ways I would say an individual can step up and help the community.
Looking at public, private, and hybrid programs that work to address childhood hunger, we see a long, long, long list. There's SNAP, which is formerly the food stamp program. There's WIC, Women, Infants, and Children. There's TANF, the Federal School Breakfast and Lunch Programs, Summer Feeding Programs, the Backpack Program, and the Emergency Food System, which includes food banks and all the programs they serve, like food pantries, soup kitchens, and shelters. It's been said that the United States has become a soup kitchen nation, which focuses more on emergency feeding than long-term eradication of the issue. Question: are all of these programs necessary to deal with child hunger? And to what degree do they have the potential to eliminate childhood hunger in America?
So I'll tackle the first bit of your question about are these programs necessary. Last year was engaged in a study in Cook County, where the county of Chicago is home to, or is in, and we looked at children nutrition program in the summer, and we kind of looked at the patchwork quilt that was children's nutritional programming. And what we found that was no single neighborhood in the entire city of Chicago and no municipality in suburban Cook County was actually meeting the need for that program. And so I think it shows you that while when you read off that laundry list of programs, it might sound like, wow, we have got this problem covered, no problem. There is overwhelming need, and the resources that we have dedicated to meeting hunger and food insecurity are simply have not thus far been up to, you know, up to the task in terms of sheer numbers of meeting the need.
I would just add to that, it hasn't met the need, and I want to go back to that individual response of what you can do. Again, echoing, first get in touch with the Eastern Illinois Food Bank for this region and make a commitment and continue to make that commitment. Second, talk about this issue with everybody that you can. I am just amazed at about the amount of ignorance. And I don't mean that in a belittling sense, but I have had conversations with some highly, highly educated people who do a lot of work in food, as you can imagine, in this area, who believe because we grow a lot of food, there can't be any hungry people in this region. So talk about this topic with your neighbors, with the people that you go to church with, to people in grocery stores, wherever you can, because people really do not understand this issue. And, you know, the third thing is vote. Find people like Representative Jacobson that are committed to addressing this issue. This is an issue that's being addressed at the state level, at the local level, and at the federal level. I truly believe that our subsidized food programs probably are, they're not addressing the need. They need a careful look. They're in, you would not believe the number of bills that they're attached to at this point. And we need to keep a careful eye on them to make sure that that money is well spent and that it's not dropped and forgotten, because they're also very, very vulnerable. So that's just my little two cents.
National experts suggest that federal policymakers can end all hunger insecurity as a national problem by strengthening existing federal programs by about $12 billion a year. But there is certainly passionate debate around the issue. For example, right now on Capitol Hill, they're struggling with how to fund additional dollars for child hunger issues. Some lawmakers wanting to take the dollars out of TANF. So here's a core question. Do you see it as the government's role to end hunger as an issue, and if so, why?
I say absolutely. I think that government is the only place where we can affect systemic change. We can all do as much work as we can as individuals and as communities, but if we're going to change the fact that millions, you know, 37 million people are poor in this country, I think that's the old stat. I think it's more than that now. You know, and that they don't have access to food, you have to change something bigger than actually just, you know, emergency food assistance. So I think, you know, as an individual, not only voting but advocating and pushing your elected officials to not only vote for increases in food stamps, which is important because it helps people feed their families, but for promoting policies that ensure that people have access to a sustainable livelihood for their family. I think that that is absolutely critical in this entire scheme of thinking about solutions.
I agree 100%.
Dr. Knight, there have been significant reductions over the past several years in uninsured children through Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and All Kids Expansion. So how do we build on the success of these initiatives to ensure that every child has health insurance?
Find an endless bucket of money, which I don't think is going to happen. I think that you have to build on success. I mean, you have to look at those things that have worked and try to replicate it. I think that you have to take critical looks at things that aren't working and decide how you can change them, improve them, or frankly, eliminate them so you can put your focus in another area that's working. And so I think that we have to continue to look at the problems, we have to look at the solutions, and we have to build on what works, but change things that don't work. And frankly, if there's some things out there that aren't working, get rid of them so that we can continue to do the right thing. And those are the things that are working.
Dr. Hillier, will you touch on the CATCH program and the summer feeding programs?
At Public Health, we work with schools to offer a program that's called a coordinated approach to child health. And it focuses on four components: health education, nutrition, PE, physical activity, and a home component. And it just works to create an environment at the school so that kids can make healthy decisions. It makes it really easy for them to make healthy decisions. Some of the things that Barb was talking about, like changing birthday policy so that students are bringing in healthy snacks. Along with that program, which actually has nothing to do with the program, is the Fresh Fruit and Vegetable Grant that a lot of our CATCH schools have received. The way that works is that schools get to offer to their students a fresh fruit or vegetable a couple times a week outside of lunchtime. So it's a separate snack, and it has to be served raw, and all they can do is cut it. So it's a great experience for students who maybe have never seen a kiwi, star fruit, squash, to be able to try that and taste that and, you know, kind of get that exposure and experience. It works well with the CATCH program because the language is go slow and whoa. Students can have go foods and as many go foods as they want in a day, and then there's slow foods, and then whoa foods are kind of reserved for special occasions. So there's no foods, but it's a great opportunity to teach the kids about go foods and let them access those foods. The summer food program we've offered at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District for two summers, and I think I mentioned before that because we're close to two schools that have a high free and reduced lunch rate, that we can just offer it to anybody who's under 18, one to 18 years old, who comes into public health. So we kind of thought that we would just serve our clients in our waiting room that way. But it turns out that because we did it a second year, I think that exposure really helps. So we increased our numbers quite a bit this year. And I don't know that it was something that we were or weren't going to continue a second year, but it helped us realize that it's important to, once you establish a resource, even if it seems like, oh, we really didn't get a large response from this, that you keep at it, because once it becomes a standing resource for the community, then they will access it. Another program that you didn't ask me about, but I'm telling you about anyway, that kind of has that same feel to it. We our WIC clients get farmers market vouchers to spend at the farmers market. Certain farmers take them. They have a sign, and you can use them there. And they weren't being redeemed at a very high rate, so we thought that it would be a good idea to offer a farmers market at public health in our parking lot, somewhere where our clients are used to accessing. And the first year, it went okay. We had one farmer that stopped coming because he really wasn't getting enough action. The second year, we offered it every week. And I was really impressed that we were able to do that because we, you know, had, you know, really didn't see a large improvement the first year. And the second year, the farmers were happy, but really we didn't see an increase in redemption rate. This year we don't have the numbers back, but we're still doing it. And I always check in with the farmers when I leave, and they always have like a nice stack of WIC vouchers. So I think that we are starting to become established as that resource, and people are using our markets. We also do have the link card redemption there too, so people can use their link cards there. And we've seen that a lot more this year, but in previous years it was only like a couple dollars, so any improvement is huge on that end. But I think it's just a matter of getting established as a resource. So even if you find that these programs aren't being accessed the first year, just keep them up so that you know, people know that you're there.
Ms. Daly, would you highlight the backpack program?
Well, the backpack program is a program, how we do it in Rantoul might be different than in other districts. It can be used for low-income students, or in Rantoul we use it for our homeless students who don't have access to as much food as they need. The verification for the kids that qualify is done at the school level, and once we know our numbers, we work with Andrea from the food bank and Kristen, and we are funded through the United Way. And I don't know, is it $150 this year, $175 for one student to get a bag the size of a regular Walmart bag full of kid-friendly foods, foods that they can open and that they like. And the backpacks are delivered to the regional office. The packs of food, I'm sorry, are delivered to the regional office in just plain white sacks. We have five schools who fax us a list of how many students in their building will be getting the food that week based on attendance and who's there. And it's normally the same number unless students are out for some reason. And we put the food bags in tubs, one tub per building. The Rantoul City School transportation driver comes and picks up the tub and delivers it to the social worker's office in the particular school. At the end of the day on Friday, or the last day of the school week, the kids, 2 or 3 minutes before the bell rings, they go down to the social worker's office with their backpack. They have their books in there, and she just simply very discreetly puts a little white sack in their backpack and zips it up. And they go back to their classroom and exit the building with the rest of their class. And in that sack is enough food to keep them pretty well sustained through the weekend. And we have it for our junior high. And we're now looking at doing either a small little pantry or some sort of food source for the high school. And that's how it works. Do it every week.
For our radio audience, you are listening to the 4th Annual Hunger Symposium, co-sponsored by the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and Illinois Public Media. Our panelists include Dr. Napoleon Knight, Medical Director of Hospital Medicine and Associate Medical Director of Quality for Carle Foundation Hospital and Carle Physician Group, Amy Terpstra, Data Analyst at Social Impact Research Center, Dr. Barbara Fees, Director of the Family Resiliency Center, Dr. Nikki Hillier, Program Coordinator for the Division of Wellness and Health Promotion at the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District, and Barbara Daly, Assistant Superintendent at the Regional Office of Education for Champaign and Ford Counties. We've reached that point in the evening where we want to hear from you. We want to take your questions. And in the spirit of trying to get as many questions in as we can, I'll ask that you try to be brief and try to focus the best you can on childhood hunger issues. I'll be out in the audience with a microphone, and if you would like to ask a question, just raise your hand and I'll come on out and find you. I have seen in the school district that food is delivered to children and it's less than tasty. It's cold. It's not appealing in any way. And so children tend to not eat it, and the garbage can fills up very quickly. And so a question that I have is, are there any controls on the food lunch program is in terms of its delivery and quality issues? And if not, should something be done about that?
Yes, we definitely need to improve the quality of school lunches and school breakfasts that are delivered to the school. The breakfasts are usually a lot of foods that are high in sugar, and fat. So I think that is really important that we address that issue, but it's huge. So it becomes really challenging to kind of figure out how, and every school district is different. So some of the smaller school districts have more control in terms of what they put out. They have a kitchen right there in their school. Some other schools, they don't have kitchens. So that's why they use that mechanism where they have the central kitchen and food kind of gets delivered. And you're right, a lot of times it looks, smells, and maybe even tastes unappealing.
During the discussion, reference was made to policy changes that have led to increased participation in food security programs. For example, Ms. Terpstra mentioned that there's no more asset testing, I believe, for eligibility for SNAP programs. I'm wondering what other policy changes have been effective in increasing participation, and what policy changes still need to be made to reduce barriers to participation.
That's a great question. Some of the ones that come to mind that I think can really increase access, and some that have been made that are increasing access, are things like no wrong door policies, so that you can go to your local DHS office, or you can go to any DHS office instead of only the one that's closest to your house. Maybe you want to go to the one that's closest to where you work. Things like that. Extending office hours, so it's not a 9-to-5 gig. I'm recognizing that people perhaps work from 9-to-5 and can't get there. So some things that are actually really simple that maybe don't necessarily require big legislative changes, but are more kind of admin things that can be changed at that level that just need some tweaking, really, to make things more accessible for folks. And I'm sure that there are larger things as well, but some of the small things really have made and can continue to make a big difference.
I would just add streamlining the application process. A lot of the applications are online, but not everyone has access to a computer. And if you've tried to fill out a SNAP application, some of it's quite confusing.
Are we not taking these common sense ideas to heart?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think that, sometimes you get really entrenched in the way you're doing things. When you're talking about, applications, you're dealing with technology issues that require an investment. So I think there's many barriers, some of which are potentially easily overcome, and others which are going to require a little bit more thought and planning and monetary investment to actually get us there.
So I have an example of like a barrier that was really easy to overcome that we just changed a policy of a way that we did something at public health. So a proof of income is to have your Illinois public aid card, your Medicaid card. So if you have that, then we can enroll you in the WIC program. You get a new public aid card every month. So sometimes people don't have them with them. They don't have their up-to-date card with them. But we could install our computers with access to a site where if you had some information on the person, you could look it up and see and find their public aid number. So we just change it so that if a client comes in and they don't have that, then you look it up for them. So that means that person who didn't have their card doesn't have to, go home, make another appointment, come in on a walk-in day, or go home and come back and public health is closed and they were unable to get what they needed. So that was something that we could do really quickly and easily in-house.
Hi, can you all hear me? Okay, this is a question for both Ms. Daly and Dr. Hillier, and it's pertaining to how we make the shift from what kids should be doing or what families should be doing to how to do it. I think both kids and adults understand the link between, what foods you should be eating and the health outcomes that they lead to, but how to actually access the food, prepare the food, and just knowledge of different types of food that are affordable is not really out there for these families. And specifically for the schools, something that we can do, I guess, at the individual level of the child, and it's kind of independent of all the other problems going on in the family and community, some of these, this nutrition education, so teaching kids how to go about doing these things at a very early age. How can we do that at the school level when I know a lot of the attention is being placed on other subjects, and schools are sort of mandated to spend more time on these other topics because that's how kids are being tested and how they're, you know, getting money for the schools. So a lot of the focus on mandated health classes and teaching kids how to do this is kind of taken off of the health. And then for communities, things, for example, using your WIC vouchers or your SNAP benefits at the farmers market, people know that this is available, but the sort of the difference between the what to do and how to do it is not necessarily out there, especially when farmers markets don't necessarily fit the typical profile of these people who don't necessarily have these resources, and they're not used to going to these farmers market. And then the stigma surrounding, you know, using your vouchers. So how do we get these programs to, how do we shift that focus?
Well, the first part of your question about shifting from what to do versus how to do it, the CATCH program focuses on the how to do it. The earlier K through 2 curricula is more like information, what is GO food, what's slow food, what's WO food. But as they get older, then they apply that, and the teachers model the behavior of the students. They get to plan a party with healthy foods. They get to make healthy snacks. So they get the opportunity to not just learn, but to practice those health behaviors. And then an important component that goes with it is the home team piece, and so that everything that the child is learning, the parent is learning too. So in the earlier grades, it's just newsletters that are going home. This is an example of a GO breakfast. This is an example of a slow food, you know, different things like that, so that the parents are getting the information too. And then in the higher grades, they have homework assignments where, we did a family walk together, check. Oh, we looked at a food label together, check. So it's things that they can do together as a family, and it does kind of apply that how-to. The other thing that we do is we offer classes to people who are interested in healthy food preparation, menu planning, shopping and those kinds of things. And then what's the other thing? Oh, the farmer's market thing. So I hear what you're saying about how a farmer's market might be kind of intimidating to someone who hasn't been there before, or that it's just kind of maybe not their environment. And I think that was really the motivation behind offering the market at Public Health, was kind of to familiarize people with, you know, engaging with farmers at the farmer's market. You talk to farmers. You can ask them what to make with this vegetable, or you can ask them how to tell if this vegetable is appropriate, or, you know, you can talk to them. And it was kind of an effort to get them used to it and teach them, to, you know, what signs they have. But I think that there's still more work to do probably on marketing that and helping people feel comfortable using their, you know, link card and WIC vouchers there.
You know, the other half of your question about do we have time in the school day or an inclination, even because we are held to such high standards with annual yearly progress. In the school code, every building has to have a wellness plan, and that hasn't always been. The focus on wellness has turned a lot of the, I would say, old-style health programs in schools into more of the wellness approach. We see, especially through the CATCH program, and our schools are increasing the numbers of schools that are adopting that. Instead of, I'm in first grade, I'll do health here, and then I'll go to PE, now we're seeing a networking among different specialties. So the PE might transfer to the classroom, the classroom wellness might transfer to the PE. So it is mandated that they have to get those minutes.
And, one more thing about CATCH. We work with teachers to try to encourage them to just give their lesson plans a healthy spin. So if the concept that the child has to learn is graphing, then have them bring in boxes of cereal and graph how much sugar is in each one. Or if there's an exercise on measurement, then we will give them a thing of Crisco and measure how much fat is in what Susie ate that day or a certain menu item or something like that. So we just encourage teachers, like, we know you have to meet certain standards, so while you're meeting those standards, can you put a healthy spin on it? Can you teach the kids something about wellness while you're doing it so that it doesn't take away time from the things that they're tested on and that they need to know at the ISAT test?
The problems with kind of implementing kind of administrative reforms within the Department of Healthcare and Family Services is just, it's a bad situation that's just headed in a worse direction until we have revenue reform in this state, because with staff layoffs that they've had, their processing times are just getting worse and worse, and offices are being closed. I mean, you had said, well, maybe you can visit the one that's closest to you. Well, down here, there aren't a lot of options, and in fact, some of the smaller rural counties, they just don't have offices anymore. So that's a real problem that everyone needs to think about, the implications. You know, we can just sort of slash administrative spending so far, and it really does impact services that people receive. Secondly, the North First Street Farmers Market, which hasn't been mentioned yet, also accepts food stamps, and this past year we were able to offer double food stamp value, up to $10 per household per week, and it was very well received. We had some foundation funding to offer that and plan to do it again next year.
I'm a happy volunteer at an evening food pantry that does accommodate folks, families who cannot be available during the day. I want to speak just briefly to the issue of community planning and the placement of stores where we sometimes do not have food stores. We have ample liquor outlets. In food stores where we do have them placed, larger areas are given over now to the prevalence of liquor displays. I've noticed those displays moving forward and center in stores more and more. And at the food pantry where I do work, we've noticed there are some number of folks who come who have been using that liquor. And that's a matter of choice and family style of life, I guess. But I wonder if you have any comments about the prevalence of the problem of consumption and also tobacco use. We notice a lot of tobacco use.
I guess I would just say that goes back to the question of individual responsibility. Those are bad choices. In my mind, and people need to make better choices, understanding that, you know, some of those people for multiple problems, you know, have difficulty dealing with the circumstances in which they find themselves. But it's a bad personal choice in my mind.
But you are in a unique position to highlight resources, and I know that you do. So because you do have access to people that may have be addicted to tobacco or alcohol, and so it's a good opportunity to offer resources to people who might need those.
And perhaps, I mean, education. I mean, perhaps those individuals don't know that what they're doing is not necessarily good for their health. I mean, I still run into individuals like that all the time that tell me that they don't know that what they're doing is bad for their health, and I believe them most of the time. But, you know, perhaps, you know, to the degree that you can, some education, you know, might be useful. I don't know if those resources are available, you know, in the food bank itself.
I had a question relating to talking about the Catch program, which is a great program. But yet we still have a SNAP program, which from what I understand, there still aren't, you can still get junk food. You know, you can't purchase alcohol or cigarettes, you can't purchase pet food, but you can still buy junk food. So you can, you know, I'm thinking you've got a child who's at school and they're learning, you know, how great it is to taste and cook squash, but if they go home and there's a bag of potato chips, and from what I've read, they've found that it's very expensive to try to limit the things that people can purchase with their SNAP vouchers. Do you see it being worthwhile, or is there a way that, because my understanding is with the WIC program, there are limits on what can be purchased. Yeah. So why can't something be put in place with the SNAP? And at least then if people in order, you know, to purchase food, they're having to purchase more healthy choices, and they're going to be forced to learn to, you know, to be feeding their families these, and maybe that will kind of filter on out.
I think it gets kind of sticky when you're saying that, you know, they're forced to do this. So I think that's probably where the issue comes in, is that, you know, limiting people's choices. The WIC program, because it's just women, infants, and children, and it's a supplemental program, that's why they can sort of give, you know, a couple of different choices in terms of the vouchers and what people are eating. And you're right, I think that there is sometimes a disconnect between what the kids are learning at school and then maybe unlearning at home. And that's the hope, is that if parents are getting that information, they are modeling that behavior. But we know that doesn't always happen. But if a lot of times parents do report, like, you know, she said we can't have chicken nuggets anymore. Or, you know, she was critiquing what we were eating for dinner. And I say, that's a good thing. You know, that means that, you know, they're learning and they want to teach you. So, I do want to acknowledge that there is that disconnect, but there's also some happy stories in there, too.
I was going to add that, you know, the foods that are allowable on both WIC and SNAP programs, it's not that they are just what I guess you would consider less healthier foods. It's that foods that are high in protein are more expensive. And so when you have to balance $4.50 for a meal, you're going to have to make some choices. And what's going to last the longest? I just did an experiment. I teach a class called Food and Family with undergraduates. And so this past week, I decided I was going to cook three healthy meals that were going to come in at like $4.50. And, you know, first of all, it took me a lot longer at the grocery store because I couldn't buy just what I was really in the mood for, and that was fresh and that was local. But I had to really stretch, you know, the dollars to make it work. And then I asked the students, pick out the dish here that you think was the most expensive. And I made some sort of omelet that had potatoes in it. It looked the fanciest, but it was the cheapest. The thing that had meat in it that I found on sale was the most expensive. And it was very, very hard to find a way to make those make that food, the healthier recipes. So I don't think it's just that people don't always make choices because they're not interested in having a healthier diet, but you got to make that dollar stretch.
Yes, I'm Bob Goss, Daily Bread Soup Kitchen. I just want to announce that we're going to reopen the 4th of October with hot foods. Previously, just soup and sandwiches. We will now be serving hot foods 5 days a week. Remember, we're the homeless feeding the hungry and the homeless. And all your statistics are correct. The number of children we're getting, the number of families. So we will go now from, used to be 60 to 70 meals a day. We will actually start out, I think, right off the bat with 400 to 500 meals a day. We have no federal aid, no state aid. It is this community that is allowing this to happen. So it is the community we say thank you. All volunteers, no paid staff. So it can happen. But once again, get out to your people. Let them know we are open. Hot meals every day, 5 days a week. And they will go home with a meal to take home with them as well. And we do have healthy food that they can eat. And obviously meat, as you said, is expensive. Bless the food bank's heart, because we couldn't do without them, as well as other community help. With that, we'd pass it on to them. We'd appreciate it. We expect a lot of hungry guests. Thank you.
I just wanted to know if there's a coordinated community effort to address this, and if so, how do agencies get involved or connect with that effort?
That is a tremendously great question, because our staff over the last several months have been trying to develop some sort of an umbrella approach to childhood hunger.